Good evening, James McKenna here with my Science Hour, August 17th, 2017. And a special, special announcement. Everybody's been waiting for the latest announcement for the wing generator. I'm opening up licensing for the wing generator, and that is on my webpage. There's a description there and information on how you can obtain a license for developers. And this could be a single person at a house, or this could be a group of people or a corporation, etc. There's different categories. And so it also includes a licensing. It allows you to build a certain number of these, and along with the certain qualifications for the licensing. But anyway, that's a big announcement. So go to the webpage, jmccsci.com, and get the information on that. Tonight, I'll be talking about some generalities, and that's because something big is coming up in your and my future. So I'll be talking in parables, so to speak. I'll be talking a little bit about natural law, ethics, truth of the universe, and the law of leeches. How does that work? Anyway, first a commentary on the situation with North Korea. Understanding the history of this is very important. The $4 billion that Bill Clinton gave to Korea back in, 1994, with the alleged promise that they would not develop nuclear weapons. And of course, that's what they did. But that was just the ticket in the door. That was just the gate. That was just the down payment. That was the dime to get past the threshold. They have spent, that is North Korea, unbelievable amounts of money on military. If you compare the North Korean military forces, they rival Russia, China, and the United States. Now, where have they been getting this from? Where's all this money coming from? Of course, they trade with China, and they've been putting a lot of their gains into military. But also, they've been buying technology. So clearly, they've been buying it from China. Arms dealing is a major, major business in the world. And Russia, France, United States, all of these countries partake in this. So understanding Korea, the North Korea, that is, Kim, the little puppet ruler over there, is a puppet. He was educated in Switzerland. His dad was extremely wealthy. He did business with the Clintons behind the table, under the table. But understand that when Bill Clinton went to China and gave all of our nuclear secrets to China, and other technology, literally all the technology, that was a planned banker move. That's what the Rothschilds do. They need a balance of power. And I saw this personally when I was in Los Angeles looking for money for my own ventures, my space science ventures, etc. This goes back to the early 1980s. After I left Cornell, then I started working in private industry, and then I also went to Los Angeles to raise money for my science projects. And in that, I got an in-depth view of venture capital, international venture capital, the military industrial complex, the aerospace industry, the black ops, the military, and a whole laundry list of other not so good things, including what later became known as Iran-Contra, because all of these people were involved in that. But what I saw was that the military, the engineering, the aerospace corporations, etc., as soon as something was developed in the United States, some new widget or some new advancement in aerospace technology, it immediately went to Russia. Immediately. And you saw it in the mission of the Russian military at the Paris Air Show, the big international air show where everybody shows off their military wares. None of this is main secret security. That's a bunch of baloney. Because the Rothschild bankers maintain their power by keeping a very close balance between all countries. So if one country gets out of line, like Germany did before World War II, creating their own banking system, or like Russia is doing right now, that's why all of the hyperventilation over Russia now. It's not because of collusion in our election. Hey, the United States hasn't had a fair election in 100 years or more. So don't even worry about that. I mean, the foreign country collusion doesn't hold a candle to the collusion and cheating that's going on in the United States itself. That's all just hot air. But the bottom line is that the Rothschilds maintained their power by keeping all countries on a tipping point. And that's what North Korea is. They have been stocked. You got to ask, where did they get all this money? They didn't get it. They did not get it from trading with China. I mean, you know, they bought technology from China. China bought it from Russia. And then on Iran, $150 billion from the United States went to Iran, and it was used to purchase U.S. uranium that went through the Clinton Foundation backdoor deal, selling 20% of the United States uranium holdings to Uranium One, a Canadian front organization company for Russia. Then it went to Russia. Then it went to Iran. So we bought our uranium with billions of U.S. dollars in Iran. And now they're on the verge of having nuclear rocket capability. In other words, warheads that are deliverable by rockets. Thanks to Obama and the Clinton State Department. So that's all fact. That's not politics. That's not Democrats versus Republican. That's the Rothschild banking empire working through your good old federal government to do damage and keep this. See, they have to keep the boogeyman out there. They have to keep some bad guys out there. And anyway, the results of all of this, well, I'm not even going to talk about that. But I just wanted to make it clear how things got to where they are. And the United States involvement in this through the Clinton, the Bill Clinton, the Bushes, and back to the, through Obama, who was just a puppet of the bankers. So that's how things got to where they are today. Update on NASA asteroid, 2012 TC4, I believe it's called. I talked about this last week. The scientists at NASA on, I love this name. I'm just trying to figure out who comes up with these names. OSIRIS-REx. If that isn't right out of, just skull and bones and, you know, secret New World Order mumbo jumbo, I don't know what is. But I want to mention the tier two bozos at NASA who run up to the podium like little schoolboys, all gleeful that they're going to have a chance to look at an asteroid. And NASA built this spacecraft, OSIRIS-REx, to go out and land and take a little scoop of dirt away from it and bring it back to Earth, which is, once again, a terrible idea because that asteroid is full of viruses. That's what they found on the surface of Comet 67P when the European Space Agency landed. They found basically nucleotides, basically the nucleotides of DNA all over the thing. So this is just loaded. These things in outer space are loaded with viruses. And they don't know anything about this asteroid. They're not going to have contact for days before. Then they're going to shoot this rocket, try and orbit and land on it and bring something back. All a stupid idea. But once again, this thing just stinks. It just reeks of false flag. And so, I mean, we don't even know that this thing exists. This whole thing could be an entire hoax, because they claim they saw it in 2012, and that's the only data that exists in the internal bowels of NASA. Well, would you trust those people? And even at that, the space scientists don't see things. They just get data. So these Tier 2 people literally have never even seen this. It would be easy to fake data, hand it to them. And then, like I said, maybe I have my tinfoil hat on a little, you know, too much here. But it comes along, too. I mean, you're just getting bombarded with this asteroid hitting Earth stuff. Remember the recent rapidly put together show, TV series still going on, I believe, called Salvation, Wednesday evening primetime, glossy Hollywood production. And the public is just being slammed all of a sudden with all this asteroid stuff. But let me add that this is one of the false flag narratives that was given to us by Wernher von Braun back in the 50s when he said this is what they're going to do to bring around the New World Order. And believe me, those people are, they're not doing well. They're not doing well. They've lost in Russia. They've lost major countries of the world around the globe, including South America, Africa. And they're struggling to maintain power. And now the United States, Britain, of course, they're struggling to reverse the Brexit, which is the public vote to leave the European Union. They're struggling to keep that from actually going through. And the United States, they don't have their man in Washington, or woman, whatever. So once again, this thing just stinks and reeks, and the BS meter is going off because the story doesn't make any sense. Like I said, if they wanted an asteroid to land on, we have asteroids a dozen a day that come between us and the moon. We know their orbits. We know their orbits within, you know, a few hundred kilometers. This thing they haven't seen since 2012. It could be anywhere. It could be, they said, as close as 4,200 miles or as far away as 170,000 kilometers away from Earth, or miles. I forget what it was, miles, kilometers. But still, a tremendous gap. And this thing's going to come flying in at, you know, hypersonic speed, outer space speeds, and zipping by, and they're going to try and launch a rocket and catch up to this thing, and they don't even know what the orbit is. It just doesn't make any sense, because we know of all kinds of asteroids that we do know the orbits very exactly. They've been studied. We know where they are. We have all kinds of characteristics. And this is supposedly a test of the Earth Protection Network at NASA. Well, you know, come on, boys and girls. I mean, this is just taking the balloon and stretching it till it pops. This story does not make sense. And excuse me for harping on this, but this is coming supposedly October 12th. And if it comes by and, you know, I don't know. It just, the story doesn't make any sense. That's all I'm telling you. And also, as I said before, that Salvation show doesn't make any scientific sense. I mean, it's okay Hollywood production, but in terms of science, it's off the wall ridiculous. So the question is, why is all this being thrown at the public? And when you see this, and if it was just this asteroid deal, okay, well, okay. But this Salvation show chucked in with it, and all of the other, you know, hype that's gone with this and this type of topic recently, you know, it just smells rotten. That's all I can tell you. And you, the public, are getting slammed with this. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. Okay, on to a quick topic here, the water filters. We will be getting back the stainless steel. We have some actual projected dates now. Around September 10th, we will be shipping stainless steel, the kitchen standard, and the traveler, the smaller stainless steel. And so I'll be putting those up. Maybe they're up already. The traveler had been taken down from the sales page. Be putting that link up again. And with a special, with like the Econo package, where you can buy it with another 10 extra filters, it comes with two, and that'll be up on the webpage. So people can actually start ordering those again, but just understand, you know, we're about, you know, a number of weeks out yet. It might be a little sooner, we don't know for sure, because we're retooling the tooling to make those stainless steel containers. But just to mention, everything else is available on the sales page. You know, the replacement filters, the JMCC, because the JMCC GF filters all in one, no need for priming, which is a terrible idea. Don't ever buy a filter that you have to pump water backwards in. I mean, talk about ridiculous. You're contaminating your filter before you even use it. What a ridiculous idea. And literally all other companies, if you're going to get arsenic and fluoride out of the water, you have to purchase those add-on filters, and they only last for 500 gallons. So my filters are the only ones on the planet made in the USA. Everybody else, they're made offshore, China, India, wherever. And believe me, they're not tested. There's no quality control on those. And so mine are made in the United States, in our own factory, tested NSF certification standards, and no requirement for add-ons, no priming required, and they cost lots less because you're not paying for all that shipping and customs and stuff to bring it in from some foreign country. Okay, quickly, the MR5 and MR9, those are the multi-round, large-scale commercial filters, high-rate flow rate filters that you can use in your house. And people are buying these. People are very happy with them. They're putting them in their house. You don't have any other filtration in your house then. This goes to the shower. And believe me, you don't want to be showering with chlorinated water because that turns into a vapor and then you're breathing it. Believe me, the cost of this versus, you know, a trip to the hospital with cancer, you take your choice. I'm not saying it prevents cancer, but it'll stop that vapor of fluoridated water and chlorine and glyphosate and everything else that's in that water. It goes into steam, and you're breathing that in the shower. So these whole house filters, the smaller one is really good for probably 99% of all houses out there. But what I'm telling you is that the replacement filter packs, I have a super sale. It's 10% off on the filters themselves. So instead of like, $3,100, they're like $2,600 for the smaller unit. But the replacement filter pack, if you buy it with the initial purchase of the unit, they're $500. That's like almost half price for the replacement filter pack, and then $750 replacement filter pack for the MR9s. And these things last a long time. We're talking 50,000 gallons or 100,000 gallons of usage, unlike anything on the market. There is nothing like this. So go to the webpage, jmccsci.com, check those out. And on to the main, just don't forget my paid cast, The Science of the Colburn. I'm having a lot of fun with this particular series. It's a 10-part series. Remember, I finished the Cosmos series, the real story, and now I'm on to The Science of the Colburn. And this is a complicated topic, taking ancient texts and interpreting them according to real science, not fairy tale science or not ding-dong science that you get on the internet. This is real science, comes from a real scientist, and The Science of the Colburn, something that you really don't want to miss. That's in the paid cast, $3.95 a month for that extra hour per week. And these are priceless, priceless And I also show you the links of where to get the real Colburn, not the imitation one. It's a complex story. So let me go on to the main science topic here. Going back to the Greeks, the Greek mythology, and the Greek stories and the Greek plays. Remember that that's where we learned about Atlantis, by the way. But they had all kinds of tragedies. The Greeks loved hardship, and they were of the bent, of the mindset that man's plight, the problem with man, was that not only did the gods like to toy with man and play with man, because the gods were really jealous of man, because man had a body and a free will and could have fun and drink and be merry and get married and have kids, and the gods couldn't. The gods were restricted in all kinds of ways. So they were very jealous of man. And they also were very, let's say, not jealous, but preemptive about man getting technology. And so remember, who was it? The guy that gave fire to the Greeks, and they staked him to a mountain where an eagle came and ate his heart out every day. You know, so that was their response. And I often wondered, because back in the real early days of the Greek, where the mythology really came from, could it have been possible that Atlantis had nuclear capabilities? And it's not really that difficult. And I would say that the answer is a very likely yes. But the Greeks were commensurate with Atlantis, remember, until the downfall, until the Venus event came and took it all, just like leveled the playing field, so to speak, on Earth. But I want to concentrate on a myth of Sisyphus. Now, Sisyphus was also a guy. And when you offend the gods in Greek mythology, let me tell you, things are not good. But Sisyphus had to roll a rock up a mountain. And he did this every day. He'd start at the beginning of the day, and he had to roll his rock up the mountain. And when he got to the very top, the rock would roll down. He'd have to go back down. And the next day, he'd have to start rolling it up and do the same thing over again. Well, Albert Camus wrote an essay on this. And, of course, Camus was a philosopher. What would you call him? A person who wrote about the plight of man, about the plight of man kind of marching through molasses when the molasses flow is against you. I'm not sure how better to explain it. But existentialism was one of the terms used to describe this, the existence and the plight of man. But let's change, and by the way, Albert Camus wrote an essay in dealing with the myth of Sisyphus and the plight of man, existentialism, etc. And I thought, wouldn't it be interesting if Albert Camus were living today? He could rewrite his essay, and maybe it would go something like this. The old Sisyphus rolls his rock up the hill, and the next day it rolls, you know, that night it rolls back down the hill, and he's got to go back and down and roll it up the hill again. But let's change the story. Let's say that the next day, the mountain is 100 times higher, literally, 100 times higher. And he's like, oh, ooh, this is not good. Okay, so he rolls up, he gets it all the way up to the 100 times higher mountain, higher, and there it goes. Rocks rolls down to the bottom again. Next day he comes, but he looks up at the mountain the next day, and it's 1,000 times taller than it was the day before, which means it's 100,000 times taller than it was the first day. Anyway, and let's just add a little twist to this story. You say, well, why is this guy rolling up the hill? And the idea is that if he can get it to the very tippy top of the hill, this is my twist on the story, if he can get it to the very tippy top of the hill, it will roll down the other side of the hill and get to where he wants to go, and he's all done. But he never seems to get there because every day that mountain gets, you know, 100 times, 1,000 times bigger every day. And then the next day, another 1,000 times. So this is like, you know, a billion times bigger in a couple of days than the original mountain. So he's rolling them up the mountain. And so one night he comes back down. The rock rolls down to the bottom of the mountain. There he is waiting till morning to roll the rock up the mountain again. Some guy says, hey, Sisyphus. I got an idea. How about we just roll the rock around the side of the mountain over here? It's not very far. And then it'll get to the other side. And by this time, Sisyphus has a whole team of people. And these people are all calculating and figure out ways to roll the rock up, you know, with greater efficiency and et cetera, to get up to the top to try and get it over the top to the other side. And so Sisyphus is not by himself anymore. He's got a lot of people helping out, okay? And they're all, you know, they look at the mountain, they go, we got to get it up over the mountain. And so this little guy comes over and says, hey, taps Sisyphus on the shoulder and says, you know, Sisyphus, if we just would roll it around the side of the mountain here, we'd get to the other side, be a lot less effort. We wouldn't have to go up. We could just go around and it would take us about half a day and then be done. And Sisyphus looks at him and says, no, no, there's a rule, and we got to roll it up over the mountain. And all these people here have been working with me for a long time now, and we are going to roll it up over the mountain the way we originally planned. So the guy goes, well, okay, but anyway, what I'm going to do, Sisyphus, is I'm going to make public the plan to roll the rock around the mountain. And I'm just going to let everybody know that, you know, everybody's standing here every day watching you roll the rock up the mountain. And I'm just going to let them know that it'd be pretty easy to do it this way, but you chose not to. And that's the end of my story. So Sisyphus, at the end, with his team, keeps scaling the mountain in defiance of any logic or reason. That's the end of my little story. And so this is preparing you for something that's I'm about to present to the public. Let's just put it that way. So think about that. Think about that over the next week. And think about the plight of man and think about the things that we do on a daily basis. But more so, think about what professionals do on a daily basis. And they do it because they're locked into a pattern and they cannot see their way out of that pattern. And if they stopped performing by that pattern, everybody would go, hey, you know, you've been rolling this rock up this mountain here. It gets bigger every day. And this is essential too to what I'm going to be presenting, is that the mountain gets bigger every day. You know, if it were the same, well, you'd think, well, okay, probably got a chance of getting it over the mountain maybe one of these days. But this mountain keeps growing by leaps and bounds every day. You know, it gets harder and harder and harder. And at a certain point, you go, gee, maybe we should just kind of roll it around the side of the mountain and be done with this deal. Anyway, think about that. And I'll be back talking about that next week. And next week, I'll give you the conclusion to this little narrative. Okay, so this brings us up to a topic of natural law ethics, the truths of the universe, and the law of leeches. Now, what's a leech? A leech is a little blood-sucking, like worm-like thing or snake-like thing that attaches onto fish, primarily fish, and sucks their blood, basically, and lives off of it. And there's no better way to say it. And so we use that term loosely in English to refer to people who do basically the same thing. They hook onto somebody, they suck the blood out of them, and basically kill the source and So let me go back to the idea of natural law, ethics, and the truths of the universe. What we, and let's talk about science and related fields. Now, I've been talking in my paid cast quite a bit about natural law, ethics, truths of the universe, etc. But imagine that the universe is an organized place. Now, there are people out there who believe that the Earth is bent in chaos, that everything we see is the result of chaos. Just random, you know, everything coming together at random, and total disorder. Now, you can look at a carbon atom through a spectrometer. A spectrometer looks at the wavelengths of light that are characteristic that come off a particular atom. And how many carbon atoms are there in the universe? You know, countless, you know, in the terms of our, you know, meager ability to our finite imaginations, countless, infinite number, more than the grains of sand on the beach, certainly because every grain of sand has countless carbon atoms in it. And every tree that we see or plant has countless carbon atoms. So think of the number of carbon atoms in the whole universe, and they all act the very same. They all give you the same characteristic spectrum when put under the same conditions, heated up or put into an electric field or with an electric current passing through the carbon gas or whatever. All of those carbon atoms have the same characteristic spectrum. They all respond the same. They have the same absorption spectrum. They have the same, all of the same characteristics. They have the same number of electrons, same number of protons. Of course, there's variations. You have carbon-12, carbon-14, but even within those variations, once you're a carbon-14 atom, that's what you are. And, of course, these things can migrate back and forth, but if you become a carbon-14 becomes a carbon-12 atom by some process, then that's what you are, and you respond according to the laws and the rules of carbon-12. If you were carbon-14, became carbon-12. Okay, so the point is, where is all of the chaos? How did you would expect the carbon atoms on the far side of the universe to be all different. But they're not. And you find the entire periodic table, which is the building block structure of all matter, of you, me, you know, trees, earth, dirt, sun, galaxies, everything in between. Where's the chaos? It's like saying there's chaos when there's obviously none. So this is a dichotomy, this is a quandrum, the quandary in science today, that people are saying things that just don't make any sense. And then you see, like, you go out to visit a comet. You get to the comet, there's no water coming off of it. The scientists see that. They say it under their breath in scientific meetings. But then publicly, they come out and say, yeah, there was a lot of water there, and that it's a lie. It's a lie. Strictly a lie. So this is what we see, well, like with politicians. You know, the sky is blue. Well, they'll call it green. Everybody's, well, it looks blue to me, but everybody's saying it's green. Maybe I better say it's green too. You know, that is the mentality today, and that's why it is so difficult to talk about science today, because people's perception of reality has been so twisted. Take the term relativity. When relativity came out, the existentialists grabbed a hold of it and they said, oh, everything is relative. You know, something that's good for you is bad for me, and something that's good for me is bad for you, but it's all relative, so we're all good. Well, no. There is a natural law, and in college, when I went to school, they actually taught a course called ethics. Then after that, you took a logic course to learn how to reason and to understand reasoning processes. For example, if we can prove some concept, A, then B follows some other concept, and then possibly C follows from that, from B. But if you cannot prove A, then none of this works. But there's another way of viewing this, that if you prove B and C, that doesn't prove A. And so let me use a quick example. Let's say you assume that the Big Bang exists. Okay, so you start looking around for evidence, and then you find redshifts. Okay, you find that galaxies are redshifted. Okay, well, that's a symptom of the Big Bang, potentially. Could be a symptom of many other things. Could be a symptom of other scientific principles at work. Then you find that there is, say, a microwave background radiation that you can measure with your microwave satellite. So you measure that, and once again, that could be due to the microwaves that you're measuring from outer space, could be due to other things. But you conclude that that proves the Big Bang, which was your assumption. That is faulty reasoning. And that is why when you go to, if you went to a real school and learned real science, real mathematics, and real logic, and real ethics, you would not allow yourself, nor would you allow anybody else in the scientific world, to take pieces of data like redshift and microwave background radiation and say it proves the Big Bang, because the Big Bang is the assumption. So how would you prove the Big Bang? Well, in science, it requires direct observation, and since nobody was around back then, it's a speculative theory. In all of the subordinate measurements that you make, do not prove it. Do you see what I mean? So, to understand, and this is being passed by the public on a daily basis. Oh, we see the redshift. That proves the Big Bang? No, not in anybody's book at all. But you have scientists, space scientists, astronomers, etc., making these claims. And, of course, all the glossy magazines, none of them understand logic. None of them understand natural law. Now, when Bertrand Russell, the great logician, developed ethics and tautologies and logic, it was based on natural law. In other words, these were fundamental principles that you would deduce if you were on the far side of the solar system or on the far side of the universe. Now, let's take another view. How about general relativity? Well, you cannot get black holes and big, big, big celestial cosmological things in your laboratory to determine if bending of light. I've talked about this last week about the solar eclipse. I'm not going to go into that again. But you cannot get the sun or massive objects into your laboratory to test to see if gravitational fields, in fact, can bend light or cause redshifts or cause X-rays. So scientists look out in the cosmos and they go, oh, there's some X-rays around a place. We don't see anything local there. So that must be a black hole. That proves black holes. They're looking for dark matter. They can't define what dark matter is or what properties it has. They know what properties it does not have. That doesn't do you a lot of good when you're looking for something. Try and find a boyfriend or a girlfriend based on all the properties you don't want. Well, you probably should have a few that you do want based on, you know, whatever. That's just a kind of a bad example, but it's apropos because in everyday life, we make decisions every day based on value judgments. And then sometimes we find out, ooh, that wasn't correct. But let me take one more example. Comets, comet nuclei. Now, for decades and decades and decades, comets were elusive. We had not seen one. We had not been to one up close. And so it was always assumed that there should be ice and snow basically making up this nucleus, and that's where the tail came from, etc., until we started getting up close to comet nuclei. In my, I believe it's in the Atlantis to Tesla book, I talk about fluff, fluffier, and fluffiest. Or maybe that's in the Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book. But at any rate, it's a little story. Goes back to 1986 when Fred Whipple was invited. He was the originator, not really the originator. He was the promoter, let's say, of the, in the 1950s, Iceball Comet model, which later became the Snowball Comet model, which later became the Dirty Snowball Comet model. But anyway, he was invited to the French location where they were watching the monitors for the Giotto spacecraft to arrive at Halley's Comet. And that was the only spacecraft that had a camera on it. The Japanese had a spacecraft. There were other spacecraft visiting Halley's Comet, but the Giotto was the only one that had a camera. So anyway, as they approached the nucleus of Halley's, they were breaking through the coma, coming in. They were, and the nucleus was a very bright white area. And so they kept seeing this, and they got closer and closer, and then it started getting to have a defined shape, and it looked like a potato. And all of a sudden, it kind of like flashed into brightness, and Whipple says, "There it is. There's the nucleus." And at that point, the Giotto spacecraft finally broke through the final cloud coma layers above the nucleus. And what he was seeing was this pure white, snowy-looking object, and that his expectations, that's what it should look like. And as the spacecraft broke through the final clouds, it showed the blackest object ever to be recorded in any space venture. Blacker than coal. And it left everybody speechless. But then they came back and they said, well, it's still... Now, it's just a little dirtier than we thought, but it's still a snowball. Absolutely. And this is what I'm talking about. Natural law, ethics, the truth of the universe, and the law of leeches. At that point, the scientists should have stepped back and said, uh-oh, this is wrong. We have to follow data. The data says that this thing is black. There's no snow there. And then, subsequently, there have been another, eight or nine comets that have been visited at close range, and not a drop of water on them. Not a drop. Nothing leaving the comet nucleus. They landed, the comet 67P, the European Space Agency landed with the Rosetta mission lander, the Philae lander, landed on the nucleus of a comet, no ice, no snow, no water, made of basically hydrogen, carbon, oxygen, nitrogen compounds, basically the building blocks of life, but absolutely no water, ice, or snow, and nothing coming off the nucleus to create the tail. But geological processes going on, dust storms, there's no atmosphere there. Geological processes actively occurring on that nucleus. So imagine that science is at the point where data is ignored to the point where, yeah, the sky is blue. Somebody says, no, it's black. Okay, everybody's got to say it's black because your paycheck depends on it. This is going on not only in the science world, but related fields. And that's why I'm kind of dancing around the topic that I'm going to be presenting to you next week. Something is going to happen next week on my show, and it's going to be a presentation. I'm very happy because this is finally, after literally maybe 5, 10 or more years, this is finally coming to fruition. So anyway, listen to my show next week, but I'm trying to prime you the story of Sisyphus, the story of my extension of the story of Sisyphus, natural law, ethics, logic, the law of leeches, and the inability of modern man to get over this you know, if the comet doesn't have any snow on it, then it doesn't have any snow on it. It's not a snowball. You cannot continue calling this a snowball. People that criticize me go, oh, yes, they found all kinds of snow and water associated with comets. Well, yeah, you see it in the tail, but there's none on the nucleus. And that's what they've been saying. See how the lie, the slip slide, the stage left, how they, you know, change the story, change the narrative, and then say water is associated with comets. When they had the Comet Vild 2 deep impact spacecraft approaching, it was on July 4th, what was 2000 and was it 5? I was a guest on Coast to Coast AM. We were waiting for the data to come in, and it was promised by NASA to be immediately released. And they were expecting this big plume of ice and water to come out when they had the impactor hit the nucleus. And, of course, I had predicted exactly what was going to happen, that there would be electrical activity, and the impactor would discharge before it got to the nucleus of the comet, and there would be a flash. And all of that happened. And then the impactor hits, and there's a little bit of dust that comes off the surface, and that's it. But here's my point. A day later, there was an excitation of some kind relative to the comet, and there was more water in the tail as observed from Earth. So they said, oh, that shows that the impactor belched up this big cloud of water and resulted in the extra water in the tail. With the water in the tail, the extended water in the tail was observed at Earth. There was nobody that could see the nucleus or verify that anything came off the nucleus. In fact, the verification was that only dust came out of the nucleus when the impactor hit. But do you see how they lie? These are professional liars. NASA, the scientists, the space scientists, the astronomers, the outreach people, the Naval Observatory spokespeople are professional liars. So if you have science, you can't even call it science anymore. It's the politically correct agency that takes our money that's supposed to do science. Now, I'm not sure if there's a word for that. I think we got to invent a new word here. Let's call it the sluence, because a slough is like a swamp. A slough is like a marsh. And so if it's full of bacteria and mold and things that aren't true, you know, slip slide, where nothing seems to be as it is, then instead of science, we'll call it sluence. And that's the new word I'll use from now on. Sluence. And they get paid. It's a highly profitable enterprise called Sluence. And the videos that you see on YouTube, instead of calling it science at NASA, we'll call it Sluence at NASA, just so that you know that everything you hear there is going to be a lie. But now remember that this is something I believe I mentioned on my paid cast, but I'll repeat it here. Everybody has natural law instinctively in their spirit, in their persona, in their brain, in their heart, in their makeup. And you say, well, no, there's some people out there that are cold. They don't give a, you know, they have no compassion. Ultimately, they do. They have just gotten to the point where they override it. But that's why a thief steals at night. That's why a thief breaks into the house and doesn't want to get caught. They do everything they can do so they don't get caught, because they know it's wrong. Or the politician, or the person ahead of a political party, that they do all of this underhanded stuff. And then when they start to get caught, they start to hide things. They start to cover it up. That's why, Congress, That's what they do when congressmen first get to Washington, D.C. They become compromised. There's a dozen ways the CIA has tried to compromise me a dozen times, and they failed because I work alone and I know their tricks. They've done everything in the book to try and compromise me. And that's why they don't like me, because I don't play their games. But everybody else out there, all these scientists that go to work, they get their PhD, they go to work for NASA or university, these people are green behind the ears. You can trick those people like taking candy from a baby. It's just so easy. And then you got them. Then they got them on a contract. They got them with some kind of agreement that they had to sign or whatever. I never stuck my foot in any of those traps. That's why I'm doing what I'm doing today. I'm not rich, but I'm talking. I get to say what I want to say, and those people don't. Those people got to keep their mouth shut, because otherwise the kids ain't going to college, the house doesn't get paid, and the wife is going to be mad. You know, I don't buy that. I don't play that game. Never did, never will. And that's where they get these people trapped. So that's why if you look at government or university science or the whole publication, publisher, parish, peer-reviewed journal, grant funding system, top-down NSF, National Institute of Health, the Center for Disease Control, World Health Organization, pharmaceutical corporations, Monsanto, you know, I could go on for 20 hours listing everything. That's what you're just being flooded with lies, deception, and everybody in this system has written in their heart. That's why they do this they create laws which protect them. Why do they do that? Because they know that if anybody with half a brain caught them doing that, whatever they're doing, they take them out and string them up, and that'd be the end of it. So they do everything in the world. So natural law is written in everybody's being. It's part of it. Ethics, logic. But people will skate around it. The news media, the science news media, the corrupt fake science news media, National Geographic, American, Scientific American, the Discovery Channel, the History Channel, you know, Sky and Telescope, Astronomy Magazine, Discover Magazine, the list goes on and on. Those people make money and they don't ask questions. You know why they don't ask questions? Because they don't even want to know the real answer. They don't want to know the real answer, because the real answers would mean that maybe they're not going to get their paycheck. There's a term called NASA proof. Congress, and it's also called Congress proof. NASA is Congress proof. NASA put their contracts in every constituency in the country, every legislative constituency. And they did that for a reason, because then it would be political suicide for any politician to vote against a NASA project, because they would cut, you better believe, that if there was a cut in funding and it was voted on by some congressman in a certain district, they would go directly to that district, cut those jobs, and say, look, your senator, your representative here, cut your jobs. And they would make it public. So it's Congress proof. So no congressman on the planet's going to vote against NASA. And so what do? They have a gig. They can lie. They can cheat. They can break all ethical laws. They can put out garbage. They can lie about scientific data. They can hide it, and nobody will say a word. Once again, the media, the fake science news media, goes along with this. When the Giotto spacecraft arrived at Halley's Comet, and all kinds of other things happened, it went in front of the comet. It hit the electron beam, which I predicted, knocked it off course, completely off course. The electron sensors went off scale, and oops, you know, how's a dirty snowball do that? Well, it doesn't. How about the 21 pieces of Schumacher Levy 9 that hit Jupiter with vast explosions discharging the Jupiter fusion capacitor before they hit? The Russian scientists who I was working with at the time came back and said, that proves it. That proves there's no dirty snowball, because a dirty snowball would just have burrowed into the atmosphere of Jupiter, which is very, very deep, and you wouldn't have even seen anything. The explosions were so intense, they were on the far side of Jupiter when they happened, they were so intense that the reflected X-rays off the moons on the far side of Jupiter reached Earth with enough intensity to be measured. That's how intense those explosions were. So the Russian scientists said, absolutely, that's the end of the U.S. NASA Dirty Snowball Comet model. And it's still here today. That shows the level of lying that can occur. That was 20 years ago. That's the level of lying that can occur, the lack of ethics, the lack of truth, the lack of natural law, and the law of leeches, because those people are making money because they're hiding the truth. Okay, so anyway, next week, I'm giving you this introduction, because next week, tune in, because all I'm going to tell you is I'll be presenting something that has been in the wings for a long time. I'm just very happy that this is finally coming to fruition. In fact, I'll have 3 major announcements next week. So tune in for that. Once again, remember the webpage, the sales page, the paid cast, the ongoing series, Science of the Colbrin, the sale. Now you can start purchasing the stainless steel containers again. They will start to ship in about the second week of September. That's our current estimate. And the MR, the multi-round filters, are 10% for the sale on the filter, and that comes with one filter pack. And then the second filter pack for the MR5, the smaller one, which is plenty for anybody's house out there, the MR5 filter pack, normally $845, on sale for $500. So that's when you purchase it with the initial unit and the MR9, which is the bigger unit. I mean, this is an industrial size unit for farms or ranches or horse ranches or industry. The filter pack normally there is like almost $1,400, half price, $750. And so that's when they're purchased with the initial MR filter. And the way you order, by the way, is you send in an email. All the information is on my webpage. We send you an invoice, and then you pay it through PayPal with your credit card or with PayPal if you'd like. And then those are on the shelf. We're ready to ship. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. Remember the webpage, jmccsci.com. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.